Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Welcome to Radio Oldie. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today's guest definitely qualifies as a national treasure and one of the most evergreen and popular presences on our television screens. Michael Palin needs very little introduction, especially to oldies who, like me, never missed a single episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus back in the 70s. Michael's career since then has demonstrated just what a versatile and talented person he is as an actor, a writer, and television presenter. His hugely popular books and travel documentaries have brought us insights from around the world, and between 2009 and 2012, he was president of the Royal Geographical Society. He was knighted in 2019 for services to travel, culture and geography, an indication of just how widely he has employed his talents. Michael Palin, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here. I can talk about being an oldie without being embarrassed about it, because I'm with the oldies.
we're all the oldies
and the wises.
That's good, yes, know? We're all wise.
Yeah, we're all wise. And we're all falling apart. No.
No, we're not. You look terrific.
That's a false head.
So we are here to talk about everything, but let's start with your latest book, which is about Venezuela. And you said a really interesting thing, actually. I was reading on your in one of your blogs, I think you said that touring it around, you're getting to know England very well too.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's a very strange thing, because I'm often asked, why don't you do a programme about your own country? And I said, well, everybody's done programmes. There's so many books about this country, books that I think are great. But also, you know, I said, I don't know where I'd start or where I'd finish. Whereas if I go abroad, you take on the particular country that you've chosen to go to, or countries, as in the longer journeys I used to do. And that's exciting, and that's thrilling, and that's going somewhere else and seeing something you've never seen before. On the other hand, what has happened is, because of all the journeys I've done, and they all have a book, so I come from some exotic, wonderful place where everything is new and different, and come home and find myself in Yeovil or sort of Tynemouth or, you know, Dundee. Everywhere's different. I mean, just down the street is different from up this end of the street. I love that. I love the differences in places. I'm very much against sort of uniformity.
I quite agree. So in Venezuela and all those places you go to where you've probably never been before, how do you start researching it, and who's guiding you around it, and how do you meet everybody, and how set up is it all? Or
since we did North Korea.
That was quite a long time ago. It was still quite a long time ago,
2018 or something like that. It was just a very lucky period when they opened up for a couple of months or so. And a director called Neil Ferguson, he'd done a lot of travel programmes with people like Joe Lumley and others. And he was the one who came and said, look, we can get into North Korea, and I'd like to work with you. And so we talk about it. He goes out, does a recce. While he's out there, he meets somebody from the country who becomes really the second most important person after Neil in the whole
thing. The fixer.
It's a local fixer. Mm-hmm. And then you've really got to get the right person.
Yeah.
And if you get the right person, then, you know, it's great. What you don't want is someone who will tell you what you can't do. You want to get someone who will tell you what you can do, despite, you know, the government and all that. So he's got to be somebody who lives in the country, yet can work sort of around all the regulations. And then we go and film. It takes about 3 weeks. We get 3 series out of that. And I then come back and write the book.
It's a very interesting time to be writing about Venezuela, because it's been so in the news with all this horrific bombing of the supposed drug-carrying boats.
Yeah.
Were you there when all that was happening?
No, we filmed in February and March. And anyway, this all kicked off the Trump's sort of threats to Venezuela. All kicked off about 2 or 3 months ago, I think it was during the summer.
Yeah.
And he suddenly decided, I think because they're just interested in showing off American power wherever they can.
Yeah.
And these these boats that they attack and just demolish. I mean, they make sure that they're not just, they'll just disable, they're sent to the bottom of the sea.
And killed, everyone's killed.
Yeah, 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 everyone's killed. Oh, that's, yeah.
And there's no proof that they're drug runners.
They're all narco-terrorists, he likes that.
Terrorists, yes.
Narco-terrorists. Yeah. And they're going to bring down America. And again, it's something which I find so sort of appallingly sort of stupid and insular. Is that, I mean, it brings down America because Americans use drugs in an enormous amount. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Okay, some poor guys who live in Venezuela. I'm not saying they're nice, the gangs. They're probably rather unpleasant. But, you know, to say without that, America would not have any drugs at all, it's just absolutely sort of putting your head in the sand.
Of all the countries you've been to, which is the one that surprised you the most?
Well, that's quite a good question, really. I'm trying to think. I suppose, actually, oddly enough, there's a country I went to called Moldova, which is quite a small country. On the edge of Russia, and we went there. And,
when was this? When did you go?
2006. So it was about 20 years ago. We went there, and not only was it sort of it was a lovely, comfortable country to be in. You felt it was a very small country, really threatened, and yet there was a kind of feeling of pride in the country. And a feeling that they were determined to keep this little area to themselves, the Moldovans. They had a chance to do it. And yet, half the country is there's a place called Transnistria, which is Russian Moldova, and where the Russian army goes in to prop up the government. So it's a little kind of splinter country, but it goes down the centre of Moldova. So they're right on the sort of battle lines between East and West. And yet, it was a comfortable country, nice wine, nice food. But they had this tremendous sort of small, but a real sort of David and Goliath feeling there. I like that. I like a bit of diversity, and I like to see countries which have, you know, feel they have their own culture and their own way of doing things, which is different from the people next door.
So let's go back to your acting now. I don't know where I read this, but apparently you did your first part aged 5 as Martha Cratchit.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I think I was older than that, actually. I think I must have been 8 or 9. Anyway, but yeah, I was Martha Cratchit in A Christmas Carol. And my friend Graham was Mrs. Cratchit. And the director, who happened to be the French teacher, Mr. Fisher, and decided that he would do a bit of sort of
where was this?
Real
what
drama.
School was where
it was
you?
A prep school in Sheffield called Birkdale, and he decided, you know, to add a little sort of method acting by making sure that people came in from the rain. It was a rainy day outside, so he sprinkled a watering can on you before you went in. Unfortunately, Graham was supposed to just get my bonnet off, and it was a ribbon under the chin, and he couldn't get it off, and it tightened. I thought it was going to be some strangle, so I had to sit through the entire meal with water dripping off my bonnet onto the Christmas pudding. But yeah, that was very early.
But it didn't put you off acting, obviously. So
well, it didn't, but it's interesting about acting, because I was quite shy at school, actually. I wasn't the sort of person who would put their hand up as soon as the teacher said any idea. I'm quietly at the back of the class. I'd like to be at the back watching what goes on, which is what I do now, really. But I had a talent for imitating teachers, you know. That was the first thing, I suppose. I was able to do their voices and their mannerisms. I've just been fascinated by the behaviour of the person in front of me, and how he did, and what he sort of, when he sighed, when he got cross, and, you know, when he scratched his ear, and the fact his trousers were torn, you know, he didn't know because it was at the back, and all that sort of thing. That would be fascinating to me. So I would then get the voice. So I was able to sort of, you know, not exactly perform, but bring him to life. And I suppose that was a talent which I sort of discovered.
So when did it sort of kick off properly, acting? Was that at Oxford or...?
No, it was actually before Oxford, what they call now gap year, before going to Oxford. And lots of people now go off to Bali or, you know, the Hawaii or something like that. I went about 5 miles away in Sheffield and worked at the steelworks where my father was working as export manager. And there I met a guy who said, oh, if you're interested in acting, we have a very sort of busy programme of acting for a local drama society called the Brightside and Carbrook Cooperative Players.
You never forgot the bright side. That's gone on.
Bright side, you know, is one thing that was a sort of joke in Sheffield, really. Well, it was in the north. You know, amateur dramatics are very, very important up there. They took it very seriously. And the first play I did, The Woodcarver, it was called, that did quite well. And then I did a couple of others with them, usually very gritty, all about sort of, you know, guerrillas in war and all that sort of thing. But we didn't do any light comedy.
No. When you went to Oxford, you met Terry Jones, of course.
Yeah.
And then you also met somebody called Robert Hewison, which I'd love you to tell our listeners a bit about, because you said somewhere that he was the one who suggested to you first that you could make a living by making people laugh.
Robert was, still is, very, very important in my life, because we met at the door of Brasenose College gates, and he was rather cocky, I thought. You know, he was kind of metropolitan and seemed to have a certain swagger about him. And I was a sort of snotty-nosed Sheffielder who didn't really know what pizza was, let alone anything else, you know. So. But so I thought I was going to really hate him because he was quite funny and he made others laugh. But we became really good friends. Because I think we were both huge friends and fans of Milligan and Peter Sellers' records around at the time. And Robert sort of took me under his wing, really. And for a while I thought, well, what I should do is I've got to do some sport. So I played football for the Brasenose sort of team, I don't know, the first term. And at the end of it, Robert was just rather disgusted. I mean, he was quite an aesthete. He said, no, you have to throw away all these muddy things. You don't want to do that. It's absolutely ridiculous. Just get covered in dirt. What we can do is we will write a cabaret together. So Robert fabricated this cabaret, and we did it together. And I would never have done that if I hadn't met somebody who was that sort of had that sort of confidence, I suppose it was, really.
So out of the cabaret grew the Pythons, eventually, sort of. So how did all that happen?
Tradition at all universities, especially Oxford and Cambridge, and Cambridge particularly, of doing amusing shows, you know, and getting clever, witty men up on stage. And Cambridge is the footlights. And I was asked by this guy, Doug Fisher, if I would be in the 1964 at the cast of the Oxford Review at the Edinburgh Festival. And I mean, I was quite young then. They were all older than me. I thought, oh, great, yeah. And that was just a great turning point. So once we'd done that review, I did another review, helped write the next year, and my friends at Oxford were all people who were writers or performers. 2 years after I left Oxford, Terry Jones, who I'd made very good friends with, said, I've just heard from David Frost, and he came to see the review in Edinburgh. I said, yeah, I remember that. And he said, well, they want us to be writers on a new show called The Frost Report.
Amazing.
And on The Frost Report were all sorts of writers, you know, great names like Dennis Norden and Marty Feldman, and Barry Cryer and all that, but also John Cleese and Graham Chapman from Cambridge and Eric Idle from Cambridge. We'd all been through the same sort of process, I suppose, of writing our own material, standing up on the stage, playing to about 50 people at most, and trying to make it all work.
So the Pythons, it was agonisingly short-lived for fans of it.
Yeah, we did three series, and at the end of the second series, John particularly was getting restless and wanted to go and do his own thing. And I think that was nothing, it wasn't again anti-Python, it was just that he that's the way he wanted to work. His relationship with Graham Chapman was a bit difficult because Graham drank a lot and John ended up doing an awful lot of the writing. So at the end of the third series, that was it. Although we did do a short fourth series, which was quite funny, actually, without John as a performer, but as a writer. And then along came the idea of doing a film, and it turned into Monty Python and the Holy Grail. and that did well enough for us to say, well, let's stick together. And then...
You did two more.
Life of Brian was the next one, which I think was by far the best thing we did. Consistently best. Yeah. And we did another film after that. So Python actually, from thinking it might be over by about 1972, in fact, it had another 10 years of life.
I'm really interested to talk to you about Fish Called Wanda in 1988.
Yeah.
Because you won a BAFTA for that. And you played that amazing part that was completely memorable. And
yeah.
Found out, which I hadn't known before, was that you have a lot to do with stammering charities, because your father had a stammer, and there you were playing this. Stammer Incorporated.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's a certain amount of sort of confusion in that, and why I did it, but. It's all quite simple, because John had written this script in which it was a heist, in which the person with the really vital information had a stammer, which is a very funny idea. He said, look, I know your dad had a stammer. How was it that he stammered? Because he'd written the plot out. So I said, well, yeah, it's a lot of it psychological. It's kind of... when you're under pressure, things become more difficult. When you're really relaxed, you can speak more easily. You can sing without a stammer at all. He was fascinated by all these things. Incorporated them in the movie and said, well, you must come and play this character called Ken Pyle. Anyway, at the end of it, the film did very well. And I was asked by somebody, actually a guy called Ray Cooper, who's a musician, percussionist, has played for everybody, including long tours with Elton and all that. Anyway, Ray's been a good friend for a long time. Ray has a slight stammer. He knew somebody who had started the Pizza Hut franchise, and the man who started the Pizza Hut franchise had met somebody who had worked out a sort of new treatment program for children, particularly. And he asked me if I'd do it, and I said, because of my father, and I knew nothing about my father's stammer, why he stammered. It was just one of those sort of things you didn't talk about. And here was a chance to talk about it, find a lot more about a stammer, and help in a very good cause. So it's the only thing I'd ever put my name to, and it's the Michael Palin Centre. And I'm very proud of it, because it's done terrific work, and it's been very well run for 30 years now.
I mean, I'm really interested, because my brother had a stammer as a child. But does anyone know what does cause it?
No, they actually don't. There is a psychological dimension, quite a big dimension. So if there may be some event that's happened, certainly to you in some shape or form, mm-hmm. that starts you stumbling over words. Or it can be just something in the brain. They don't really understand this, which jumbles up words when you speak.
Did your father carry on stammering till the end?
Yes, you see, he carried on stammering. And I mean, he was quite old when I was born. He was 43 when I was born. So I didn't know him as a sort of youngish man. And the stammer was just part of his life then. You know, I can remember sitting with my father and mother listening to the George VI Christmas message, and it was agonising, absolutely agonising, because he was doing the same as my father. And yet, again, you know, my father never said, look, I have a stammer because this, that and the other. But the nearest we got to it was my mother told me that a maid had jumped out on him. So, make of that what you will. So I had this image of, you know,
so that would give your mother a stammer. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't know. So the whole idea of getting involved in learning about stammering was to try and find out what happened to my father, why it happened. And it's amazingly kind of rewarding, because stammers come in all sorts of different shapes and forms. There can be a very quick staccato stammer which leads quickly to the word, and some people just get really stuck, as my father did occasionally. And I remember Jonathan Miller, so he had problems with the F word, and he lived near Finchley Road, but he couldn't get it out, so he went to the next stop. To the next stop, which you could pronounce. And it's all about strategies, really, dealing with it.
So when that part you played in Fish Called Wanda, how exaggerated was that? Or was that really quite an accurate rendering of somebody who stammers very badly?
I hope it was fairly accurate. Gosh, I mean, that was the whole point, really. But I'm afraid there were little jokey moments, which I feel a bit embarrassed about. The singing at the end... Sing it.
Your father wasn't alive to see it.
No, I wouldn't have done it.
Would you not?
No, I wouldn't have done it if he was still around, absolutely not. And the scene where, I don't know, Jamie's asking me something about the address, where something is.
And you can't get it out.
I can't get it out, and then she gives me a lovely long kiss. And immediately after that, I'm fluent. Now, that is a bit... I don't know if that's in the treatment at the Stammering Centre and all that, but it was a very nice thing to do, I must say. And also, when I started... We had... Charlie Crichton was the director. And Charlie was 80-something. I think he was... No, he's in late 70s. Very good editor, very good judge of comedy and how it all would cut together. But he had a stroke. So Charlie spoke rather out of the side of his mouth. And when we were doing the stammer, the first day or something like that, and Charlie suddenly says, Michael, that's really good, but the film's going to be 3.5 hours long if you stammer as long as that on the first scene. So I got that, okay, we've got to be careful. So I had to play with it slightly unrealistically, but generally speaking, it's all based on really the character of Ken and the fact that he loved animals and didn't like people was part of the reason why he was uncomfortable with people. So that was quite a good reason for a stammer.
So you've done quite a lot of serious straight roles as well.
I did that long series GBH, which was written by Alan Bleasdale. I all set up in Liverpool.
What do you prefer doing, comedy or just...
I don't mind, actually. Something that I feel I can do and has got some weight to it.
Yeah.
That's it, really. And I've been quite lucky. I've just kind of avoided doing anything I didn't really want to do. I mean, the films I've done... I was really lucky to do Fish Called Wanda with John, and then not much till something like The Death of Stalin, which is just a great film to be in. And I've just done some acting with Mackenzie Crook, who's written a piece about a comedy series, a 6-part series.
Have you just done that?
Well, I say just, we did it in June of this year. And it's just coming. It's coming out next year. So
is it? What's that going to be called? What's that called?
It's called Small Profits. PROPHETS.
Uh-huh.
And it's quite an interesting, quirky story. It's very, very, very funny as Mackenzie Crook can be. Anyway, but I'll say no more. It's got a sort of slightly mystical, supernatural element to it.
How on earth do you find the time to do all this and write book after book after book and spend months abroad?
Well. I had a very tolerant wife, I have to say that. Yeah.
Helen
was absolutely brilliant. Mm. Yeah. I mean...
So you met her when you were 16?
Yeah, met her on a holiday. It's a holiday romance. It was sweet, really.
Married then, 57 years.
Yeah. Oh, good. That's it.
I've done my research.
That's right, yeah. And I really mean, she was... If I'd married somebody who... was a frustrated traveller herself, I don't think I'd have done the journeys. But Helen was sort of, she said, I don't really want to do that, but you clearly want to do it, and you want to go around the world in 80 days, well, go. And I said, well, children, all that. No. I knew she could look after the children really well. She's very, very good at that. And that was always the way. I went away and would come back, and she dealt with it all marvellously.
Did she ever come with you on any of these trips?
No.
Because your children were... How many children do you have?
Three, yeah. The children were... Well, Rachel, the youngest, was just about going to university. And the boys were sort of starting in business. But we kind of knew each other so well. And didn't have to discuss it greatly at all.
No.
I mean, amazing. She kind of knew that going around the world in 80 days, which was the first one I did, and led to everything else, was something I really wanted to do. And she said, that's fine.
How did it come about that?
I'll be away for 80 days. A man at the BBC called Clem Vallance, who's had done various natural history films, things about the Marsh Arabs and all that, he had this idea of doing a Phileas Fogg's journey, but in the present day, but with no extra kind of form of transport. So you wouldn't use any planes at all. You would use what Phileas Fogg used in that time, which was mainly railways, camels, horses, ships, and you just see whether you could still do it in 80 days. And he chose me because he'd seen a great railway journey, which I'd done in 1981, the sort of documentary, when I'd gone around the country and seen trains and all that. And he said, you don't just do send-ups. I can see that you can do a serious documentary. And it worked far, far better than I ever expected.
Yeah, and it was so widely watched, wasn't it?
Very widely watched, and still, I mean, I think things like Pole to Pole and around the Pacific, we see far more places, we go to far more extraordinary, get in far more extraordinary situations. And yet... The whole idea of Around the World in 80 Days was something that people take in as the first and the best of all the things I've done.
Well, what's amazing is that your shows are so popular, there is this thing called the Palin Effect.
The Palin Effect, I think that the clearest example of that, which I thought was interesting, was in when we did Sahara and went to Central Sahara, places like Senegal and Mali. And Libya, which people didn't go to very often. And there was a definite uptake in intrepid travellers. I mean, people knew they weren't going to go and have sort of country house hotels, but on the other hand, they saw, hey, there are these amazing old cities in the Sahara, we can go, we like being on camels and all that. So that was when the Palin Effect, but I think it was just about... What happened with the Palin Effect? About 10 people had been the year before, and after my program, it had gone up to 30. So it wasn't a huge.
I think
it wasn't
sweeping.
It's the Palin Effect.
So you write books, you're acting, you're travelling, and you're also really interested in art. And I'm in your lovely house, and you've got so many beautiful paintings. And you've been you write about art too.
Yes, I did. I did a whole series of. But not that I wrote them, but a whole series of programmes about artists, from Scottish colourists, Anne Redpath, when I started. But then we did Matisse, and also Hammershøi, Danish artist, who I think is absolutely tremendous. Nobody knew anything about him. One of the greatest sort of achievements of my life was to get Hammershøi on the front page of the Radio Times. Michael Palin discovers them. Weird. And he was a very quiet man who just did interiors of his house with his wife, usually with her back to him. And it was still there. I don't know if you... Do you know his work?
No, I don't know his work.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful.
So any more plans for programmes about art?
I don't know. I mean, again, everything I've done really depends on somebody else getting me to do it. You know, Terry Jones got me to do... Robert Hewson got me to do Cabaret. Terry Jones got me to write with him at the BBC. John Cleese, I suppose, really put... You know, in fact, he chose myself and Terry... push me into Python. So I've always had somebody pushing in the background.
So you're over 80 now.
Yes.
But you're still,
well,
still absolutely, you know, going at life. What's next?
Oh, I don't know. Probably a heart attack. No, I'm not joking, really, because I did have heart failure, which meant I had to go into have an open heart surgery in 2019. So, yeah, I have to
Was that in the middle of any shooting or anything like that?
Yeah, well, it was just after we'd done North Korea filming. That was fine. And I'd written the book about North Korea, and everything was set up for a tour. All, you know, places had been booked. That's when it happened. But since then, it's been absolutely fine.
But you don't look as if you're taking it easy at all.
Well, I don't know quite what easy is, really. I'm very fortunate because of all the people I've worked with in the past and the kind of things I've written in the books. I have a wonderful publisher and all that sort of. To be, there are nice things being offered, and I'm encouraged in certain ways. And I suppose there's a certain part of them which is quite lazy, and I do like sort of being able to just have a day off and read a book and all that. But it's just a day off. That's all I need, you know, the rest of the time. And long holidays, I'm not really quite so keen on that, or I do go with the families. But basically, I like things that engage my mind and body, you know, the travel is great. You know, physically and mentally keeps you sharp. I mean, I feel, as I'm in my 20s again, and my curiosity about the world, my sort of enjoyment of the world, a good glass of wine and all that, nothing's changed there, except that I'm 82 and not 28. So, yeah, you have more than three glasses of wine and come back on the underground, and you might well slip and mind the gap, and that'd be the end of you. So you are more vulnerable. But I don't have a sort of vulnerable button which says, I can't do this, I can't do that. I just walk more slowly. I am careful when I go upstairs, not to try and take two stairs at once. And now I get rather resentful because almost everyone's faster than me, you know. Young people scamper up the stairs on the underground. I think, come on, you know. Let's calm down.
What's your next journey?
Well, I can't say actually exactly where it is because we don't really know at the moment. And you being a journalist and putting it in a magazine, someone from Channel 5 will ring up. So we're not supposed to tell. We haven't agreed yet, but it will be somewhere out east.
That's exciting. Well, I hope you carry on. You carry on because you bring so much joy to so many people.
Oh, well, thank you. No. Well, that's a nice thing to know, isn't it? Well, I find now I'm far less full of frustration than I probably would have been. Because when you're younger, you feel so competitive. Everything you do has to be seen in relation to what someone else is doing and how they're doing it and all that. Now I feel I've done enough that I can just really relax and enjoy what I'm doing. I don't have to do more than I need, but I still have the chance to be offered opportunities and take those opportunities. That keeps me going.
And last question, really, on the back of that. You said you used to feel frustration. I think one of the things about you that's made you so popular is you're clearly very relaxed and very likeable. You know, you don't seem to have a dark, angry side. Do you somewhere?
No, I don't. I don't think I do have a dark, angry side. That's called John Cleese. I use that as an example because John, who's brilliant, mind, terribly funny and all that, but he looks for things that are wrong and tries to make them right again. Mm-hmm. Whereas I look for things that are right and just enjoy them, you know. But that's John sees, I think, sort of when he looks around him, things are inadequate, done badly, not done well, and he tries to sort them out. Whereas I think I'm never going to do that. I'd rather just enjoy friendship, which is an important thing. Be liked, as Jan Morris used to say, said to me once when I interviewed her. I said, Jan, what is the secret of all this? I just to like people.
To like people rather like than to people. Be liked. But well, you're not a people pleaser, are you? I mean, you'd put your foot down if you didn't like something.
Yeah, I mean.
Can you do confrontation?
I do every now and then, but I find it's quite complicated because usually what seems, you know, you just tell people they're wrong. Well, it's not quite as easy as that. How you tell them they're wrong and what they are like and all that. Well, maybe you seem to know. But I do try and and sort of believe generally in harmony rather than disharmony. And what I think the best thing you can do is to be able to communicate well, and that's why I don't like turning people down or shouting at people particularly until you have to at a certain point. I'd much prefer to be in agreement and be able to talk and be able to sort of, yeah, find out. You find out more about people if you're nice to them, I think.
What a lovely, harmonious place to end. Michael Palin, thank you so much for coming on Radio Oldie. It's been an absolute treat.
Well, that's a great pleasure. I don't want to sound too harmonious. I'm in a harmonious mood today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Michael Palin. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very, very warm thanks again to you, Michael Palin, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.